Hey, sorry I'm late.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay, are we... What are you doing?
Oh, I'm just sitting here hitting refresh on our Kickstarter page.
You're looking at the Kickstarter page.
I can't stop.
Alex, you are sitting there with your mouth open wide staring at your computer screen.
It's hard not to watch. Yeah.
And you are looking at the Kickstarter page for our t-shirt. This Tuesday, we officially launched our Planet Money t-shirt project. We're going to be making a t-shirt that tells the story of its very making, and we're going to sell that t-shirt to you, our listeners. That's what's happening on Kickstarter right now.
And on the podcast earlier this week, we put out a call. Everyone who wants a t-shirt, go to our Kickstarter page, pledge $25 or more, and we will send you one. And the response has just been huge, gratifyingly, unbelievably huge. The first day we blew through our goal. So thank you guys so much.
Yes, thank you. And our plan is basically to make as many t-shirts as you tell us you want. So if you do want a t-shirt, if you'd like a t-shirt that tells the story of its creation, you can go to our Kickstarter page. It'll be running for another 11 days. You have 11 more days to tell us that you would like a t-shirt.
And the idea of this project is that we're going to go on the same global journey that a t-shirt goes on. We're going to go from the cotton farm to the spinning factory. We will go on cargo boats across the ocean. Our t-shirt will make stops in Indonesia, Colombia, Bangladesh, North Carolina. And we will be reporting on stuff we learn along the way. And part of what attracted us to this idea is that there are so many stories surrounding the things we wear, stories that you would not imagine when you put on your t-shirt. Consider the material a lot of t-shirts are made from. Cotton. Simple cotton. Trying to buy cotton, it turns out, takes you into an international trade war that involves quiet money transfers, retaliation, and a $150 million bribe. That is the story we'll be telling today.
When I was a little bitty baby, my mama would rock me in my cradle in them old cotton fields back home.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Hannah Jaffe-Waltz.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. And this is the last you're going to be hearing from me for a while because, Hannah, we're turning today's episode over to a story that you uncovered when a few years ago you started shopping for cotton.
I started looking around and first just looked where cotton is grown. So cotton's grown all over the world. There are thousands of varieties of cotton. You can buy it from Uzbekistan, from Mali, Australia, and from the United States, which is where I started.
Okay. So you take seed. Well, this is the seed. It's just a little, you can touch it. And that's the seed that then we will use planters to go plant in the spring. All right, so let's go. We'll walk out here. I'll show you. Once that's planted, I'll show you a cotton plant.
Cotton seed is round and dark. It's sort of like dried black beans. And the farmer talking there is a fit, chatty guy. His name is Dalen Hancock in New Home, Texas. And Dalen says, if you want to buy cotton, the United States is the perfect choice. We are the world's largest cotton exporter by far. We've been farming cotton for 200 years, and Dalen is the fourth generation in his family. 6,000 acres of neat green rows.
Well, it's kind of far as the eye can see. I mean, that's the, I guess, the easiest way, I would say, to describe it.
Did you ever consider not going into cotton?
Yes. Whenever I was in high school, I remember I had the opportunity right out of high school to farm some land because him and my granddad was going to kind of help me, but I didn't want to farm. So,
why?
Well, I don't know. I kind of wanted to see what was out there. There's bound to be something more than, you know, than New Home, Texas.
Turned out there wasn't. There was electrician training, which Dalen didn't like, and then there was New Home and the family land. And today, Dalen's a big booster for American cotton. Texas cotton, he says, is reliable, good quality, and affordable, all of which independent cotton experts confirmed. But then, as Dalen was selling me on U.S. cotton, he kept mentioning another place that grows cotton. And this was a place I never asked about, a country none of the cotton expert people even brought up. But when Dalen randomly mentioned it, out came the cotton trash talk.
Yeah, because sometimes, I mean, just facts are facts. Brazil, for example, wants to kind of be equal to the U.S., but they also don't have the mechanism and the delivery system that we've, the infrastructure that we've had for years. I mean, years and years and years that they don't have the delivery system really to get it there on a continual basis.
Now that, the cotton experts told me, is not true. They said there's absolutely no reason to think Brazil could not quickly and safely get us cotton for our T-shirts. So why is he trash-talking Brazil, albeit with mixed sports metaphors?
The only reason I bring them up is just because they lash out at us a lot of times about how we do things and very negative about the U.S. They focus more on what we're doing rather than just worry about what they're doing. Just produce the cotton. You produce it, and you produce it at a price that's, competitive as the rest of the world. You step up to the plate and play the game. And we've played it very well for so many years, year after year after year. We're always at the plate. They keep coming to the table, kind of to the court, and always griping and always bitching and complaining whenever, we don't. And you know what? We stepped up to the plate every day and played the game.
The reason Dalen Hancock is so obsessed with Brazil, brought it up three times without being asked, there's a backstory. And the backstory begins with a guy named Pedro, a Brazilian, who disputed all of Dalen's sports analogies that the U.S. plays the game better than Brazil with a sports analogy of his own, although I didn't quite get it at first.
They're taking shots. They're taking shots.
Which shot is like when you shoot the basket?
No, they're taking shots. The shots here, the hormones, huh? They're taking prohibited. Huh? You know, they're taking hormones. And we play fair.
What Pedro means is steroids. And it turns out, how to buy cotton in the global economy, this question that we're asking, is not about comparing prices or quality. It is about this. The United States and Brazil are in the middle of an 8-year war over cotton. It's an emotional and quiet war, and where we end up buying our cotton has everything to do with this war. Now, like I said before, it all started with Pedro. Pedro Camargo. He's a Brazilian cattle farmer. He's got huge glasses and a gray, bushy mustache. And the steroids he's talking about are subsidies. The U.S. subsidizes American cotton farmers like Dalen. Depending on the year, American cotton farmers get anywhere between $1.5 to $4 billion in subsidies. Pedro does not like that. He has never liked that.
Well, I was sure that they were against us. And I had the feeling we were being cheated in the process.
Who was against you?
The rich countries.
The way Pedro sees it, the cheating happens in places like this.
All right, that sounds good. All right.
A tiny office in Linn County, Texas, with file cabinets for walls, a couple desks, dusty plants. This is where farmers like Dalen come to get their payments from the government. For reasons we'll get into later, getting money from the government is really complicated, so they need the help of the heavily braceleted Kim Paris. Kim tells me the guys come in to fill out volumes of paperwork, and then they'll stop by next month to ask volumes of questions.
Did I get paid? How much did I get paid? How come I didn't get paid on this one farm and I got paid on these other farms? How come my owner didn't get paid and I did? It takes years to understand these programs, so they think I know everything. A lot of times we'll go to the post office, grocery store, church, and they're asking us, oh, you saved me a trip, let me ask you this. So yes, I've known them all my life. If you've lived here, you've known them all your life.
Kim Paris might be the only person in Linn County who does actually know close to everything about how the various cotton subsidy programs work. There are four, and the one that gets Pedro especially worked up is the marketing loan program. And it basically works like this. So the government sets a price that it thinks cotton should sell for, a reasonable price that a farmer could cover his costs, say 50 cents a pound. But of course, the U.S. government can't tell the buyers of the world, this is the right price for cotton, pay this. Sometimes the market is willing to pay more and sometimes less. So on the months that farmers like Dalen have to sell their cotton for less, say 30 cents a pound, the U.S. government essentially makes up the difference. Twice a year, Kim Paris's office sends out a check. And so, when Dalen says the international cotton business is like a game and the Brazilians are whining because year after year the U.S. wins, Pedro's face goes all red.
Yes, they win with the help of the U.S. government, with the Treasury. And we win as a farmer. We want to compete farmer against farmer. And not Brazilian farmer and the American farmer with the help of the United States government. That's not only it's not fair, it's not following the rules.
Ah, the rules. So Pedro, like Kim Paris, has developed a specialized knowledge of an incredibly important and largely unknown corner of our global economy. In between whining, Pedro has spent the last 15 years as a farm union leader studying the Global Trade Rulebook. It's otherwise known as the World Trade Organization Agreements, the WTO. Rules that in 1994, the U.S. and Brazil and 151 other countries said they would follow. Rules that do allow some subsidies, but Pedro was sure not the ones the U.S. was paying to cotton farmers. And so, in the 1990s, Pedro began what he describes as a complaining binge. As a farm union organizer, he talked about how the U.S. was cheating to other farmers, to his friends, to the woman at the grocery store, to lots and lots of people who could do nothing about it.
I had been on this for years, and I have been looking and complaining and for years, and then suddenly I'm invited to go to government.
In February 2000, Pedro was invited to be the Secretary of Production and Trade at the Ministry of Agriculture in Brazil. His first day in February began at 9 a.m. By 1 p.m., he was telling the agriculture minister about how the U.S. was cheating Brazil. Minister, he said, we need to file a case with the WTO to stop U.S. subsidies.
On my first meeting with him, I had that. I thought, now I'm going to do it. Huh? Now I have the pen. The power to sign things, you know. Huh? I had the pen. You know, I said, oh, I have the pen. I'm going to do it. Huh?
Pedro's timing was impeccable. If he had proposed taking on the world's most powerful country, even a year earlier, he likely would have gotten laughed out of the minister's office. But Brazil was changing. It was coming of age in the global economy, opening up. It was suddenly sending things all over the globe. Orange juice to China and sugar to Nigeria. It was sending its soybeans all over the place. But what bugged Brazilians at this moment was that the rest of the world hadn't yet taken notice that Brazil had arrived. One cotton farmer told me he'd go to Europe and they'd say, oh yeah, Brazil, samba, soccer, women. And in the 1990s, when he went to the U.S., someone asked him if he ate with a knife and fork. Brazil wanted to be seen as a big guy. And to the agriculture minister and to the president, Pedro was pitching a way to do it.
And then we started looking, let's look at other cases also. Let's find a case with Europe. Let's find something with Europe and let's find something with Japan.
You set out to take on the United States, Europe, and Japan all at the same time.
All at the same time. That was quite ambitious, yes. The ambition was to be a leader.
Now, Brazil did not go after the world's superpowers without preparing. The country hired an American lawyer, and then an American economist. And then, and only then, in 2002, Brazil filed their case with the global court against the world's most powerful country. Kimberly Elliott is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, and she's studied at least 100 WTO cases.
So the first step in a WTO dispute settlement process is consultations.
That just means they talk to each other?
Exactly. The government trade ministry bureaucrats talk to one another, see if they can find a solution to the problem. And actually, quite often, in a lot of WTO cases, countries are able to resolve their problems during that consultation process.
Not so with Brazil and the United States. Talking to each other did not help. From the beginning, this case was not like the others, because U.S. subsidies to cotton farmers are very complicated, partially because it gets very convoluted when you're trying to stay on the legal side of WTO agreements. That's why Kim Paris, the woman back in Linn County who gets accosted at the post office, that's why she's probably the most valued person in her community, because she actually understands all this stuff. So the WTO does allow certain subsidies with very specific limits, and the U.S. was claiming that their very carefully crafted and Byzantine programs were within those rules. So talking went nowhere. The cotton case proceeded to the WTO's version of a jury, a panel of three international experts who sit around, study the case, and come up with a verdict.
Well, in theory, they're supposed to have 6 months. In this case, it took over a year for the panel. They said that the issues were just too complex.
And then what happened?
We were found guilty pretty much across the board.
We never imagined what resulted, this big or this good, you know. I mean, it was larger and stronger than anybody imagined.
In 2004, the victory was a huge story in Brazil. Pedro was no longer a complainer, but he was the man that had taken on the big guys. Reporters called, showed up at his door.
You know, they come to me every time there's something happens. When we win, they would come to me. Wow, brother, we won. Pedro, what do you think? I said, well, good. We won. It's not Pedro. It's not Brazil who said. It's the WTO. It's Geneva, which even has American working there.
The underdog had won, and other underdogs of the world took notice.
And so when you went to India, or when you went to China, or went to Africa, or went to even Brazil was the country which had filed the cases.
Pedro's life was different. Brazil's image had changed. There was one thing that didn't change, though. Anything else. U.S. kept subsidies in place almost exactly as they had been, kept paying cotton farmers. And the U.S. fought the decision. They appealed. That took 6 months. And then, Kim Elliott says, the appellate court came out with another ruling.
Basically upholding everything that the original panel had ruled, i.e. again finding the U.S. guilty of illegally subsidizing cotton farmers.
The U.S. appealed again. A year later, the U.S. lost again, making us 0-3. At this point, it was 2008, 6 years after Pedro filed the case. He wasn't even working at the agriculture ministry anymore, although he'd still get calls from the press.
Hey, Pedro, what about now? And said, well, now we have to force the United States to change. We would win, appeal, and this took. And the United States would completely ignore.
This is the crazy thing about the WTO. It has a formal process. It has high-powered lawyers and judges and 153 member countries, countries that bring major international disputes to its doors. And the WTO comes out with a ruling, and then that's it. Nothing. If everyone wants to obey the ruling, that's cool. And if not, that's okay, too. This really set in for me when I was talking to James Baucus, who was a judge for many years at the WTO. He ruled on things like, should the U.S. limit steel imports? And can Canada subsidize their aviation industry? Or can Japan restrict imports of American apples? And Baucus says each time, all he can do is make his ruling.
The WTO has no legal authority to make any sovereign country do anything. It has no police force. It has no black helicopters.
Wait, so all that and the WTO can't make the U.S. comply?
The United States is a sovereign country. It can choose to comply with a WTO ruling or not. There is nothing called the WTO that can make anyone in the world do anything.
So, if you're Brazil, there is only one option left, retaliation. And we're not talking everyday lashing out retaliation, but a permitted, controlled retaliation process. And if you want to understand the bizarre state of global trade, just watch what happens next. So retaliation in a WTO context means taxes. A country that wins a WTO case, as Brazil just did, is allowed by the WTO to tax the losing country's stuff. The WTO doesn't tell Brazil what to tax, but it tells Brazil how much it can levy in taxes on American goods that Brazil imports. And in this case, $570 million a year.
So the first challenge was, what products do we put in this list?
This is Renato Amorim. He was brought in as special advisor to the Foreign Trade Ministry. You can call him Retaliation Master. It turns out that retaliating is quite a skill. The point isn't to get $570 million in taxes. The point is to get other American industries besides cotton and recruit them into your battle.
So you have to think very cleverly. But so the list itself can become a negotiation, a bargain chip. And that's how you use it.
Because remember what Brazil wants to bargain for. It wants the U.S. to stop subsidizing cotton. The international court is on their side, but it's clear that's not enough. Brazil needs Americans on their side, too. Preferably powerful ones, more powerful than the cotton industry. So those are the people that it targets in Operation Retaliation.
Luxury cars, cosmetics, some medicine. You don't want to see, for example, your pharmaceutical companies, your software companies suffer because you have refused to negotiate on a trade deal.
So Renato blasts off his list of 102 American products Brazil plans to tax, and he sends it to the American Trade Ministry, politicians, as many powerful American business groups as he can think of, with the following instructions.
We will apply this within 30 days.
So basically, you have 30 days to act.
Yes. We are open to negotiation within the 30 days. So, hello, Washington, please send a team to Brasilia to negotiate. And this is what the American government did.
It worked.
It really worked.
It worked because of people like Stephen Bipes, who works at the Brazil-U.S. Business Council, an organization specifically set up to promote U.S. business in Brazil on behalf of his members, his very powerful members, such as...
We have the National Association of Manufacturers, the American Apparel and Footwear Association, the Intellectual Property Owners Association, the Personal Care Products Council, the Recording Industry Association of America, the Telecommunications Industry Association, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Wheat and Associates, and there's many others.
Many others who all care deeply about being able to export to Brazil, Latin America's largest market. On the morning the list was sent out, Stephen Bipes had hundreds of emails and voicemails from his members, members who were all wondering the same thing, what the hell some cotton dispute had to do with them. And they were telling Stephen, fix it.
Well, the first instinct is to lash out. Why is the Brazilian government doing this? Why are Brazilian cotton growers bringing this case forward? What do they have against us? What do they have against our products? What have we done wrong? So then the feeling, if you will, after some thought and consideration, shifted from the raw reaction, why is Brazil doing this, is to why do we have these policies? It was these farm programs, and I'd like to take this opportunity to laud the leadership of the Obama administration and Secretary of State Clinton, and then through the additional leadership of Ambassador Ron Kirk, the U.S. Trade Representative and Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack.
Wait, what are you doing right there? You're shouting out all the people who listened to you when you lobbied and sent them letters?
Among many others, correct. We asked all the parties, the Congress administration, to be creative, to find a solution to avoid retaliation, because it would hurt the business community. It would hurt jobs.
But Brazil knew you were going to do that. That's why Brazil put you on that list. Brazil targeted you guys because they knew that you would then go to all those people that you just listed and lobby them to get a change.
Exactly. And our community isn't reacting in response to what the Brazilian government wants. It's what's in our own best interest.
I want to just pause here to admire the elegance of what just happened, the elegance with which the retaliation master went about his business. He basically created a situation in which very powerful interests, who normally don't give a crap about what he wants, all of a sudden are his best allies. All of a sudden, American shoe manufacturers and music executives and wheat farmers are putting pressure on the American government. Just days after the retaliation master sent out his list, the U.S. sent a delegation to Brazil to negotiate. And here is where the story takes its last and final and probably weirdest twist. The American negotiators sat down in Brazil and immediately declared it impossible to get rid of the cotton subsidies right away. Farm subsidies, they explained, are set by Congress in the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill is not up for discussion until 2012. It's unclear what was said next or who promised who what. The Brazilians seem to think that the Americans committed to get rid of cotton subsidies as soon as they can in 2012. The Americans do not confirm this. What is clear is the group came to another agreement. If Brazil agreed to drop retaliation against the United States would pay them money, literally write them a check every month to stop what they were doing. It would be called the Brazilian Cotton Farmers Fund. News of the fund came out in the morning of April 6, 2010. And before noon, reporters were back at Pedro's door asking, how about instead of getting rid of the subsidies, they pay us? What do you think, Pedro? Pedro was skeptical.
What do you think of the fund, Pedro? And I said, well, I don't want the, how do you say, I don't want a tip.
You don't want a tip?
A tip. And I said, no tips. I want a solution. Eh? And I went to the press, no tips.
But then, just a few hours later, Pedro found out just how much the United States was offering. $147 million a year.
$150 million? Not a tip. Maybe it's a bribe, huh? Well, but it's not a tip. It's a lot of money, huh? For Brazilian farmers, it's a lot of money, huh?
To my knowledge, no country has ever proposed to write another country a check to make them go away in order to resolve a trade dispute.
This, again, is James Baucus, the WTO judge who watched hundreds of international cases unfold over the entire history of the WTO. To review, the United States was found to be illegally subsidizing U.S. cotton farmers. We are still illegally subsidizing U.S. cotton farmers. Instead of getting rid of the subsidies, we are now also paying Brazilian cotton farmers. And I asked Baucus, is that even legal?
It's not at all illegal under the WTO rules. If the United States came to Brazil and said, bouquet of flowers and a dozen balloons if you'll agree that our dispute is resolved. And if the Brazilians agreed, then that would be okay under WTO rules. What matters is what the parties to the dispute think is a resolution to the dispute.
The parties to this dispute seem pretty okay with this resolution. Americans seem all right with it. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that most Americans likely don't know that A, we have a cotton industry in the U.S., or B, that we're subsidizing that industry, and definitely don't know C, that we are now also subsidizing the Brazilian cotton industry as well. The Brazilian farmers mostly seem happy, too. The Cotton Farmer Association has set up an institute to receive monthly payments of $12.25 million. It'll be managed by the head of their cotton association, Haroldo Cunha. He says the money will go to things like pest control and marketing. Even Pedro, who spent 10 years complaining about the subsidies and then nearly 10 more taking the case through the WTO, seems cool with the whole thing.
Well, I think at that moment, it's hard to be against $150 million, you know, huh? It's a lot of money, huh? Haroldo was happy, you know, everybody was happy. I decided I would be happy also.
So did you win?
No. No, we didn't win. But we got compensated to wait because we still expect to win. I think maybe we'll win. And we're waiting with $150 million in the pocket. It helps.
And Alex, the Brazilians are still waiting. They will still continue to get these payments from the U.S. government until the next U.S. farm bill is passed. And that was supposed to be passed last fall. Now it's supposed to be passed in September. And so far, the Brazilians seem fine with this extension as long as they're still collecting the money. And it's unclear if the next farm bill will actually address their concerns. If it doesn't, they may have to go back to the WTO.
In the meantime, important players in the global apparel industry like us, we got to get our cotton from somewhere. And most big players don't buy their cotton from individual farmers. They won't go to Dalen or Pedro and say, hey, sell me some cotton.
Although we had to learn that the hard way.
Yes. The cotton we will buy is determined by a very, very complicated set of equations. It's determined by where we get our yarn, which is determined by where our yarn will be knitted into fabric. That, in turn, is determined by where we'll get our fabric cut and sewn into shirts. And all of this is determined by a very complicated calculus that involves trade rules and labor and geography and shipping paths. But I can tell you this. With the help of Jackie, we did solve this calculus for ourselves. And some of our cotton, the cotton for our women's shirts, will be coming from the Delta region of the United States. The cotton for our men's shirts, that is another story entirely.
When I was a little bitty baby, my mama would rock me in my cradle in them old cotton fields back home.
So, Hada, I do have this one small dream as I click refresh over and over and over again.
You have a number in mind?
I have a number in mind. You know, Jockey, they manufacture 100,000 T-shirts a day.
You're not going to sell 100,000.
Right. No, so that's not my goal. Don't worry. But what if the total number of shirts we made was 10% of what Jockey made in a day? That'd be pretty cool, right?
It would make you feel like you're a player in this global apparel
10%
industry. 10%
of this giant company. We got to 10% of what they make in a day. That'd be 10,000 shirts. Just imagine, 10,000 squirrels hoisting a martini glass across the country.
Blanketing the world.
Blanketing the world.
All right, you can get your shirt and help us get to that 10,000 number that Alex is dreaming about. Go to our Kickstarter page. You can search Planet Money on Kickstarter. You can go to our blog or planetmoney.com and find all the links there.
We'll also be tweeting and Facebooking about it for the next 11 days. And I personally will be sitting at home clicking refresh, just like Mark Zuckerberg at the end of that movie, The Social Network.
I'm Chana Jaffe Welt.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Thanks for listening.
It was down in Louisiana, just about a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields back home. In them old cotton fields back home. In them old